Just before we begin, just a reminder for people on Zoom that if you'd like to start your video so we can see each other, you're invited. So again, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. Just to let you know that there's a good number of members and some non-members who are involved in a weekend-long retreat with Brian Hindert this morning, simultaneous to this talk on another Zoom line. So, before I begin the formal talk this morning, I wanted to take a little time to do something that we used to do more often, but I realize I haven't done in a while, which is to take questions, both for people in the hall and for people on Zoom. People in the hall can ask directly, and same online. They don't need to chat. They can just unmute themselves. We study the Dharma, we hear the Dharma, we read the Dharma, we reflect on the Dharma, and then we practice. And we want to have them all very congruent so that our understanding of the Dharma intellectually and our ability to practice it, and most importantly, to integrate it, is seamless. But it often doesn't go that way. Sometimes we have trouble with some of the teachings we hear, we don't quite understand them, or something else happens as we encounter them, and we're not sure how to practice them. We may be practicing them, but they may not be producing the results that we thought. So again, what I want to do is please take a moment for everyone, just reflect and to see if you have any questions in terms of the teachings and the practice, not just an intellectual sort of question, but something that you know, has meaning to you, both in terms of, again, your understanding of the teachings, your understanding of how to practice, but most importantly, applying the practice, bringing the practice, integrating the practice into our daily life, so it makes a difference. Why else practice? And while you're reflecting, I'll just announce that next Sunday, a member who I believe most of you don't know, named Gary Hammond, will be giving the talk, and it'll be a Mind Seeking the Way talk. We've had a number of those over the past year or two, and they're really a very meaningful talk, because what the member does is they talk about their life, but in terms of the mind that seeks the way. Kind of acknowledging through everything they've been through in life, often from childhood, there's been something else going on. Something else deep inside themselves that knew there was another way, a better way, a way not to suffer, just a higher calling in life. And we call that the mind-seeking way. And so Gary, again, most of you don't know, he really does not attend retreats or intensives. He lives here in Florida, but he and I have a strong personal connection. I always, when I think of Gary, I think of Johnny Cash, in many ways. He shares a lot of similarities. And Gary also recently received a diagnosis of terminal cancer. So he's dealing with that. So I wanted to, so I invited him when we talked recently, would he do it? And he was quite happy to. So hopefully he will be with us next Sunday because he is a, anyhow, hopefully he will be with us next Sunday. So having said that, I'm now open to taking questions, both from people in the hall. There's a mic or something. Maggie on the mic. And, or if you're at home, just unmute yourself and you'll spotlight them, or how does that work? Okay, I'll leave it to Maggie. So if you have a question, please bow in and ask a question in the hall or on Zoom. And again, remember, you have to unmute yourself, which is down the bottom of your screen.
Christine bowing in.
Yes.
Hi, Fred.
Hi.
I have a question. I've been thinking about the I, me, and mine. And I was wondering, I was just thinking about an object that I owned, and it occurred to me that I don't own anything. Can objects be owned? You know, it was like a rock, and I'm like, well, I don't really own that rock.
Mm-hmm.
And I am, you know what I mean? Like, I'm something, and that's something, but I don't. And then so, all of a sudden, I started thinking about everything else.
Yeah, so hold on to that, Christine. That actually was the topic of what I'm going to be talking about this morning.
Oh.
Whether like a communion, I don't know, but so just hold on to that one.
Okay. Thank you.
Good, thank you. Other questions? Question in the hall?
Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. You're going to have to speak up a little bit because of the muffledness of the mask. We've learned that.
Okay. Is this?
I guess so. It's really for the Zoom. Anyhow, just you do your best.
So my question has to do with afflictive emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And what seems like very different instruction from Shantideva and Thich Nhat Hanh.
Mm-hmm.
Things that I've been studying of late.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's the Shantideva, it's the enemy to be, you know, to be crushed. And then in Thich Nhat Hanh, it's take your anger and hold it like a baby, a mother holds a baby. And I've been sort of trying to work through, you know, trying to do both end.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Shantideva way feels very much like spiritual bypass to me, of mm-hmm. not letting it in at all. Having the gatekeeper at the gate, and it doesn't get in whatsoever, and just, you know, and it, and Thich Nhat Hanh is like, well, take it in completely and hold it. So I've been trying to practice with both of those.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just looking for some guidance.
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's good. This is sort of the problem with Buddhism not being a dogma. You know, that, you know, this believe in this, do this, this is it, you know. As you say, and this is also historically the way the Buddha taught, and historically the teachers have taught that way ever since, which is, you know, we all want to get to the same end result, such as, you know, we want to have a mind free of all afflictive emotions, We'd like to have a mind of only wholesome and positive emotions. But how do you get there, you see? And according to the person, according to the situation, the Buddha may say one thing to one person, and the next person may come in right before him, a day later, and he may say something different. And if you were, happen to be there for both talks, you go, hold on a second. What's going on here? So again, in Buddhism, that's called, in terms of teaching and practice, all teaching and practice has to meet the criteria of appropriateness and skillfulness. Appropriateness means the teaching is appropriate to the situation, appropriate to the person, appropriate to the problem or whatever. So that's first criteria. Second criteria is being skillful. Whoever is doing the teaching, are they skillful? Are they skilled? That's the art, we might say, of working with somebody is, to be skillful, to find, what is the skillful response to a student. So there you go. So you have Shantideva. Shantideva was in a tradition where, it was very simple, right? We want to, as expeditiously as possible, attain awakening. We want to, as quickly as possible, attain a totally wholesome mind. What gets in the way? All the manifestations of self, which manifest in not only distorted thinking, but in afflictive emotions, right? And so they are impediments. They get in the way of. Get in the way of what? Getting in the way of our developing this wholesome mind. And because, as Shantideva says, and if you remember that chapter, he says, he after he goes, they're the enemy. Your afflictive emotions, your enemy. They only are doing you harm. They only, why do you indulge them, right? Why do you let them in? So after that, going on for pages and pages quite strongly, if you remember in the last page or two, he goes, but hold on a second. An enemy, and this is back in, 8th century in India, an enemy has real swords. They can really hurt you. Your afflictive emotions don't have swords. They can't hurt you at all. Why are you making such a big deal? There's nothing there. And then I think toward the end of it, he just talks about how afflictive emotions and the self that's experiencing are essentially empty of any solidity or right. So that's his way. Now again, spiritual bypassing is an American concept. That's American Buddhism, because we are in our psychological culture, we're very attuned to our psychological states, especially our unhappy ones, and we want to deal with them. Why? Because we're in the mess, you see. Shantideva wasn't in the mess, was he? He was a renunciate. He didn't have relationships, he didn't go to work, he didn't have family members to deal with. He didn't have politics. They were in a, can you see the very different world where there really was no reason to have an afflictive emotion other than you were just clinging to self, right? So the idea of spiritual bypassing, if you talk to Shantideva about it, you say, what are you talking about? Of course I want to bypass afflictive emotions, because they have no root, they have no substance. And if I totally transform my mind into a wholesome mind, they will just wither, they will die. Okay? Is that true? Absolutely true. Okay? Over here, you have Thich Nhat Hanh. Comes out of a Zen tradition, right? A very traditional tradition. Encounters the modern world, encounters the West, encounters what's going on. What does he find? See, when Shantideva calls the afflictive emotions the enemy, it's because he doesn't identify with them at all, you see. We identify with our afflictive emotions, you see. You see the fundamental difference? We think they're me, right? So, and we don't like them. But what it really means for most of us is we don't like that part of ourselves. You see, we don't like the part of ourselves that's angry or greedy or lustful or, has shame or guilt, you see? You know, so what a number of the teachers who came over to the West from Asia who were perceptive realized that when Americans went the Shantideva route, they were spiritual bypassing, you see? Because these identification with their afflictive emotions was very strong and very painful, and they thought, well, I'll just go around them. But, you know, to go around them takes a certain degree of depth of practice, you see, and understanding of the Dharma and meditative experience, like a Shantideva, or like somebody following that path. But most of us, in the beginning of our practice, when our emotional afflictions are so strong, don't have that strength. And he saw how, again, how alienated and disassociated people were from their emotions. Okay, so therefore, what does he teach? Now he, please, Thich Nhat Hanh, and it's often I've talked to people who hear these teachings, you know, years go by, decades go by, and they're still, you know, hello, my old friend, to their afflictive emotions, you see. And my point is, no. You know, we want to free ourselves from our afflictive emotions. It's the same Thich Nhat Hanh's end game, and forgive me for talking that way. Thich Nhat Hanh's end game and Shanti's, Deva's end game are the same, but he has a different way, right? Because he understands the psychology of the Western mind. So he says, embrace them. You know, call your enemy your friend. So, but really, what is he saying? So I acknowledge them, that they're part of me, right? But then what does he say? He says, you know, hold them in mindful awareness, which means you don't feed them, you don't identify with them, right? You hold them in awareness, you're present to them, you just let them be, and then you look deeply into them, right? Why? So you can liberate yourself from them. I mean, does that sort of answer your question? So, you know, so when people come to me, it's really kind of where you're at, you see? You know, if you're somebody who's really never acknowledged, you know, that side of you, right? Kind of walled yourself off or cut yourself off. Do not, it sounds strange, do not have a wholesome relationship with your unwholesomeness. then that teaching is good. But if you're somebody who doesn't go down that, who hasn't gone down that road and is fully open to their mind and their positive and negative, you know, I mean, we often talk about, you know, my dark side, my shadow side, you know, these are kind of our concepts, then there's a different way of working with them, right? And they're actually within the Buddhist tradition other ways of working with them. Beside even those two. Does that answer your question? I mean, it's really, you know, the end game is the same. We want to be liberated from our suffering. And our suffering a lot is created by our emotional affliction. So the important thing that it work, you see. Now, again, for somebody who's really not in touch with themselves or very, separate from their emotions, then obviously learning to be with your emotions, like just be with them It doesn't, you know, they're just emotions. As Shanti Deva says, which is true, you know, they can't hurt you. They don't have knives. They don't have, you know, they're just feeling states. You know, if you learn just to let them be, you can just label them, you know. The simplest thing is, I am aware that there's fear in me. I'm aware that anger has arisen in me. I'm aware that there's sadness in me. And if you can hold that without going down the rabbit hole, you see, we go down the rabbit hole with them. Right, we follow that white rabbit right down into the hole, don't we? Don't follow down the hole. See the white rabbit. Know what the white rabbit is. Just let it be. Okay? Thank you, Doug. Any other questions? Somebody chatted in a question. That's, you know, if sometimes people have questions that they may not want to be publicly identified with, so if you want to chat them in, that's fine too. Yes, Maria.
Does Dharma teaching have a perspective on suicide? I have had family and friends who exited this way. I'm currently extending comfort to a family member who has a recent loss and who is young and follows Buddhism. I want to help alleviate his suffering in this if I am able.
So I missed the connection with suicide. Are they saying that they're this friend or family member that they're counseling is suicidal or has made a suicide? They've lost somebody. Okay. Yeah. So yeah. So suicide is what? I mean, when I used to be a health professional, it would. You know, it would say suicide is a long-term solution to a short-term problem. What is the short-term problem? That somebody is stuck. I mean, really, it's as simple as that. Somebody is stuck in suffering, right? And they want out. And so therefore, not living seems a way to solve the problem of their suffering. But again, all psychological problems, all emotional problems have solutions. Every mind state is workable. So when somebody has worked themselves into a dark place where they feel whatever their experience is unworkable, it's a very tragic and dangerous place for somebody to get into. You know, traditionally in Buddhism, Buddhists believe in what? Believe in rebirth, believe that there's a continuation of consciousness. So the idea that somehow taking one's life is going to you know, end their suffering, they wouldn't consider, because they would understand that the fundamental suffering of the mind, would just travel with them. I mean, again, you don't have to accept that. So I think for, you know, and especially as Buddhists fundamentally believe in not killing, not doing harm, and believe that this life, whatever it gives us, is precious and an opportunity for transformation and waking up, to not acknowledge that opportunity that we all have, whatever our karma, whatever how it's unfold. We all have the opportunity to change, to transform, to heal. That is the possibility of all of us. So that's I would say, in a very quick way, that's Buddhism and suicide. Having said that, you know, it's it's tragic. It's sad. I mean, what can I say when somebody takes their life? Because you know that their mind state when they took their life was absolute dark hopelessness. They had walked, psychologically, they had walked themselves into a corner. Not a real, there wasn't a real corner. Because there's always something that can be done. But they had walked themselves into a dark corner where they didn't see any options. So that's sad. I remember many, many years ago when I lived in Naples, somebody I knew, their daughter, who was an adult, I think she was maybe in her 30s, committed suicide. And this woman knew me and, you know, her family, I think they were Catholic or something, but she invited me to come to their graveside funeral to speak to the family, who I didn't know. And she told me that many of them were angry at their sister, at their relative, because of what she had done. I mean, I guess she had had a history of addiction and would do well and then would relapse. So they were angry at her. It's funny, I remember saying at the funeral, please don't be angry at her. She has suffered enough in this life. And, you know, she had enough anger at herself. More anger than she could bear. Please don't be angry at her. She, at the end of it all, she was doing her best. But it's a moment alone. She got lost in her darkness, right? So, you know, I think my word to each other was, please be there for each other. And if you know anyone who is going through a difficult time right now, please stay connected to them so they don't go down that, you know, that into that dark place. Good. Good. So any other questions? Mm-hmm. Mauricio, do you have a question?
Yes, I was hoping that you could elaborate or a distinction between suicide and euthanasia in the Buddhist traditions.
Yeah, so, obviously I do distinguish between the two, and I think that's what you're getting at. You know, one of the reasons we have euthanasia in our society is a lot because our medical system has so many ways to keep people alive, right? Even if they're suffering. I mean, I think traditionally most people, when they got sick, you know, seriously sick, they died, right? Or people, you know what I mean? The exit was different. I think because we have all these magical ways to maintain, you know, the physical presence of someone without any concern for their psychological condition, which means their level of suffering, all of a sudden, you know, euthanasia becomes something people think about. And I can understand that. You know, I have counseled people, to be honest with you, over the years who have had terminal illnesses that, you know, involve significant end-of-life pain and suffering. And they've said to me, you know, When it gets to the point where the whole quality of life is gone and the suffering is just intense, you know, I think usually they would say they've saved pills or something. You know, I think that's often the usual way. Is that all right? And I would say, of course it is. you know, this is not suicide, right? This is, suicide is something very different. When someone is, okay, when someone is suicidal, you know, they still have a life ahead of them, right? That's what I said. It's a short-term solution that has long-term consequences. Well, euthanasia is really end of life. And yeah, I think quality of life, clarity of life is good. I mean, obviously, yeah. So this is what I would say. Thank you, Mauricio, for that clarification. Yeah. So why don't I kind of wrap up the questions and answers for the moment, and let's move on to Christine's question. So interesting enough, for those who were on last week, because I'm involved in the Wisdom Intensive, I based the talk on some verses from Dzogchenpa, the text we're using in our Wisdom Intensive. And so this week I emailed Ken and Betsy, who are leading the Dharma Intensive Deconstruction of the Myth of Self, to say, do you have any little pith teachings that you know, may be involved in your intensive that that maybe I could comment on? So I got back some good stuff. So, that's what I think, Christine, you were getting at. You're going, hold on, is this self that I'm so identified with and that thinks it has all these things, you know, what, you know, is it real? What am I doing here? So you're not the first person to ask that question. The Buddha asked that question. And you know, the issue of self is central. Buddhism, why? Because the issue of self is at the center of the cause of our suffering. Again, the Buddha was, you know, he was not a philosopher. He was someone who awoke from the world of suffering. And he realized that everyone has the capacity for happiness, for wholeness, to be free of suffering. And that is why he taught. And so, you know, in the Four Noble Truths, he says there's suffering and there's the cause of suffering. So when you look into what's the cause of my suffering, you know, we may have a whole plethora of sufferings that we may say that we experience. But, you know, if you go deeper and deeper and deeper, what's underneath that? And underneath it all is this strong identification that I am me, that I am a separate thing, and that the world and everyone in it and the things in it are outside of me. And so whether one identifies with me as real, solid, and self-existence, or whether one knows that it's really empty of any solidity or self-existence is very essential. So one of the things that Ken and Betsy sent me was something from Chandrakirti, who was a great Indian master, you know, from 1500 years ago or so. So this is a little verse. He says, first, we conceive the I, this is I, you know, and grasp onto it. Then we concede the mine, like mine. You know, first we identify I, and we grasp, we attach, we identify with I. Then the I creates a mine as it looks into the world and clings to all the things of the world as mine. Like water trapped on a water wheel, we spin in circles, powerless. Right? So he says, you know, once you've done that, and we've all done that, once we fundamentally identify ourselves as a separate, self-existent, permanent self, that looks out on the world and looks inward at all its thoughts and says, everything I see is mine or potentially could be mine. Like a water trapped on a water wheel, it just keeps going round. We enter what's called the world of samsara, the world of becoming, the world of birth and death, the world of change, the world of attachment and aversion. We just endlessly spin around, he says, like water trapped on a water wheel, we spin in a circle, powerless. Powerless, we feel powerless. Take a moment, is that true? Close your eyes a moment and think. Think about the world of yourself and all its needs and its wants, all its attachments and aversions, all its stories about gain and loss. All its emotionality. Don't we just endlessly spin on the wheel of self? Powerless. Just take a moment just to reflect on what Chandrakirti is saying to us across 1,500 years of time and space. Is that true? Is it true for me? Is it true of the people I live with, my family, my friends, my colleagues? When I think back of life, is that true? When I look out into the world and see what's going on out there, what people are doing and saying, is that true? Is everyone just spinning, powerless, on the water wheel of self and me and mine, I mean mine. And then his final line of this four-line verse is, again, first we conceive the I and grasp onto it. Then we concede the mind and cling to the material world. Like water trapped on a water wheel, we spin in circles, powerless. And then he says, I praise the compassion that embraces all beings. What an interesting line to put after the other three. Right? Like out of nowhere, he goes, I praise the compassion that embraces all beings. This is this compassion that embraces all beings is not our usual compassion. Right? I mean, we think a compassionate act is anything that anybody does, right, to help somebody, even in the littlest ways, to help them, to reduce their suffering, make life less difficult. We label that compassionate action. I praise the compassion that embraces all beings. So he's talking about a very specific kind of compassion, a compassion that is based on the prior three. It's not our ordinary compassion for all the ills and the problems and the difficulties and the challenges and all the things that everyone in this world is concerned about. It's a compassion of the awakened one. And we all have the power to be awakened. Their compassion is a compassion that is broken out of the world of I, me, mine. It no longer identifies with the I, me, mine, the small self. it sees how people's identification with the I, me, mine is just keeping them spinning on the wheel, and yet there's no reason for it. They can free themselves, right? So the compassion that embraces all beings is a compassion that sees this fundamental suffering of human beings and wants to free them from that, you see. See, because most of our compassionate actions, while they are helpful, you know, to feed the hungry is good, right? To give sentient beings shelter and safety is good. To create a more fair and just society for everyone is good, you see? And yet, with all that, if this fundamental problem, which is really driving the suffering of beings, is not dealt with, it will continue. So, I praise the compassion that embraces all beings is really calling upon us who hear this message to say, is that what I want to do? Do I want to liberate myself from this fundamental misperception? Because what's he saying? It's sort of like Shanti Deva saying, you know, these emotional afflictions, they can't hurt you. They don't have knives. They don't have swords. He says, first we conceive the I. Could that be that at its most apparent, the I thought, the me thought, the mind thoughts, are just words? It's just linguistics? It's just something we make up? And that we grasp at it as if it's true? And then we apply it to everything? Is that really what's going on? Is it really that simple? And that fundamental understanding that that's what's happening, and a re-identification, a rededication that is not based on this fundamental identification as a separate me, but perhaps as a we, as a you and me. And even that's conceptual. So let's just go on. Because then they sent me some more stuff from Eckhart Tolle. The book is The New Earth, right, A New Earth. I think that was his second or third book after The Power of Now, so Eckhart Tolle, everybody knows him. And if you read him, I mean, I've read him, it's been a while, but it's like, oh, it's Buddhism. so it's all very, or most of it is very congruent. So they sent me some quotes, so we'll take a look at them. Whether a child is rich or poor, whether the toy is simply a piece of wood shaped like an animal or a sophisticated electronic gadget, it makes no difference as far as the suffering of loss is concerned, right? So the child who loses, you know, if that's their main toy and they lose it, or somebody has this very elaborate, expensive electronic toy, when both these children lose it, they both suffer equally. It doesn't matter. And he says, the reason why such acute suffering occurs is concealed in the word my, and it is structural. This unconscious compulsion to enhance one's identity through association with an object is built into the very structure of ego. this is, let me just stop and say, is this true? Is this true, you know, in a certain way? Does the suffering of somebody who has billions of dollars and yet they lose millions of dollars in some deal and they suffer, right? Or somebody who has hardly anything and loses their money, we might say objectively there's a difference, but in that moment of loss, of suffering, of clinging, of not wanting, is it the same to both suffer equally? I'm not talking social justice here. I'm just talking just personal suffering. Is that true? Why is that? That whether you're, your little shack burns down, or your big 10-bedroom home burns down, why do you feel the loss? Why do both feel the loss equally? Why? The unconscious compulsion to enhance one's identity through association with an object. So again, if the word I, me, mine are simply words that we identify and attach to experience and attach, right? Then what that means is essentially there really is not a solid, separate, self-existent self within any human beings, right? It's just a creation, so to speak. But it's sort of like it knows it's just a creation, so it has to kind of find something solid, you see, to give it a sense of that I'm real. So how does it do that? It grasps at objects, and then when it brings it in and says, these are mine, it feels real. It feels solid, you see? Who am I? I'm all these things. All these things I've accumulated. That's who I am. I'm all these successes. I'm all these failures. I mean, I'm all these things. They're mine, you see? And it's funny, you know, we think, and again, you know, we live here on Nebraska Avenue, center of homelessness in Tampa, but it's interesting. Buddhist monks and nuns are homeless. They choose to be homeless. Fascinating. They choose not to have anything, right? And yet why the society, the greatest fear that people have is what? To be homeless, right? Isn't that interesting? And we look down on homeless people as if they're at the bottom, right? And yet Buddhist monks and nuns, they take a vow to be homeless, to wander about. Because the idea of not having things, I mean, I'm not just talking about the difficulty of living on the street, I understand that. But the idea of not having things, not owning things, is terrifying to many of us. Why? Because we identify with things. You know, remember the Buddha? The Buddha lived in he had a nice big house. He had lots of things. He had lots of status. He had lots of identities. He walked away from it all. You know, everybody just were like shocked. How could he do this? Somehow knew that these things because they were all impermanent and unstable, there had to be something else to produce happiness. And then he goes on a little later, he says, how do you know if you're attached to something? So again, you know, it's this attachment, right? This is how we enter the world, how the self enters the world. It attaches to things, to people, to status, to all kinds of things, to people's perception of us, or how we perceive. So it's endlessly clinging. So he says, how do you know you're attached to something? How do I know that I'm really identified with self, right? He says, well, as soon as you lose it or you feel a threat of loss and you become upset, anxious, and so on, that shows you you're attached. Okay? So it's kind of a simple criteria and has a nice emotional quality. You know, if you want to know, you know, am I attached? Am I attached to my body being healthy? Well, imagine your body being sick. You feel comfortable? Am I attached to being alive? I can freely walk into the world of birth or death. I'm just, no. Oh, no, I don't. Thought of dying, I get anxious. Right? You know, think about the people in your life. Think about the things in your life. Think about your job, your stuff. You know, if you lost them, or there was a threat of loss, are you at ease? Right? If you're not, that means there's some degree of attachment. That's not bad or good, you see. That's just a good criteria. Yeah, and then he says something I think that's, you know, very Buddhist. He said, as we have seen, having the concept of ownership is a fiction created by the ego to give itself this sense of solidity and permanency, make itself stand out, make it special. And he says again, I like his words. He says, since you cannot find yourself through having, however, you see, this is the problem, you know, even if you accumulate lots of things, right? If you when you go home, look around at all the things you have and notice, have I really been noticing them? And you might find you don't even notice them anymore. They're just there, right? You know, you see what I'm saying? Or you might not even, you know, the people you live with, relationships, you see, once you have them, they may not be that special anymore. Because I have them. So, since you cannot find yourself through having, however, there's another more powerful drive underneath that pertains to the structure of ego, the need for more. Wanting, desire, needing, you see? So that is why, even as we accumulate and have, that's never satisfying for too long, right? That's always replaced by what? Which is a more powerful drive, which is wanting, needing, accumulating, you see? You know? Because when you get into the sense of having, you've accomplished it. Ego kind of got what it's want. It's satisfied for a while, right? Whether it's a person, a thing, an experience, a pleasurable experience. All right, now I have it. Right? Now what? You see? Now what? It's like, you know, when you watch, these movie things, right? The one show you're watching hasn't even quite finished, and already they're telling you what? It's in that little corner down there. You know, I'm in awe of the sophistication of these things. You know, it's like, you know, you go on YouTube for one thing and like, bum, 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 right out along the side, you see? Because what do they know? You know, I may have found the thing I was looking for, but they know the wanting for more is in the structure of self. It always wants more. So what does it give us? lots of more. You know, I would imagine I could never sleep and there would always be, you know, more, something I could go to next. And the ego, you know, would just, it could almost be exhausted and it would still go, well, let's, you know, one more. What's that all about? We call it wanting. No ego can last for long without the need for more. Therefore, wanting, desiring, needing keeps the ego alive much more than having. The ego wants to want more than it wants to have. And so the shallow satisfaction of having is always replaced by more wanting. This is a psychological need for more, that is to say, more things to identify with. It is an addictive need, not an authentic one. Right? Because truly, not the I, me, mind, the tiny little mind that's always seeking, because you know why? Because to experience the world of the separate self is lonely. Right? It's lonely. To experience the world of the separate self is to feel kind of empty, not in a good way. Like there's really nothing here of any meaning or goodness. Oh, I don't like this feeling. I better go do something. I better go want something. What could I want right now? You see? And we, you know, what could I want right now? You see? Think about how your mind all day is giving you things to want, giving you things to need, giving you things to do. Keep us busy. Because when it stops all that, when it leaves the world of wanting and needing, and it no longer, you know, and the having the things don't give us anything. You see, sometimes people look around at their stuff and go, you know, I once went to somebody's home and I forget what happened. I saw their closet. And their closet was filled with clothes that still had the tags on them, right? And I asked them, what's that about? And of course, it's all about what? It's all about needing, wanting, getting, and then having. But once you have it, it's like, so what? You see, there's just more clothes hanging in the closet, you see? And so we always need more, you know? You look around, we go, You know, when I put that color on the wall a couple of years ago, I was all excited, right? I'm really, right? But now that I have it, maybe I need another color. You know, I mean, it's just like endless. It's an addictive need, not an authentic one. But what's our authentic needs, my friends? Our authentic need is to feel whole. Our authentic need is to be at peace. Our authentic need is to be truly happy, in a state of well-being, right? Our real needs are to come back to our interconnection with everyone. You see, those aren't egoic needs. These aren't self needs. Self, you can always tell self because self is always quantifying, right? Self is always grasping. Self is always in it for the short term. That's another way you can know the self. It's always in it for the short term. Right? It just grabs its pleasures. It just grabs its successes, right? Even though they're all short term. Why? Because it knows it'll just keep on, right? As soon as that one's done, it'll go get something else. It'll go get something else, right? I mean, that's it's because it's not real. in Buddhism, we say it, when we say the self isn't real, it's not that it doesn't feel that way. See, we kind of feel like there's a me here, but when we look into that, when we meditate on that, when we investigate that sense of me, well, for at least the 2,600 years of Buddhism, nothing solid or permanent has ever been found, which is sort of proof that even though it may feel like there's a me here, upon investigation, it cannot be found. I'll do a little experiment. Everybody close your eyes. See, there seems to be somebody listening to the talk. That's for all of you. For me, there seems to be somebody who's giving a talk, right? That's the way we think. But if you try, if you look into your own mind to see where, own body mind, can I find that person who is listening? I don't think you'll be able to find anything solid or real or permanent. Just look yourself. You know, we say, I'm meditating. That's a good one. You know, I'm meditating. I'm practicing full awareness of the body breath. But when you look for that, the one who we say is doing all that, can you find that? Just look and see. It doesn't mean it doesn't feel like there's something, because we've so identified with that for endlessly. I mean, child psychologists know that little children, infants, don't have a sense of self, really, in any kind of a structural way. It's something they develop. Something they embroider and elaborate and build on. See, we call that child development. But from another point of view, it could be the opposite. All of us as young children might have been on to something very different about who we were. And then there's another little quote they sent me. And so a power comes into your life that is far greater than the self, than the ego. All that is required to become free of ego is to be aware of it, since awareness and ego self are incompatible. Very interesting. Huh? Many of us think, oh, I got to kill my ego. Got to destroy this thing. It is such a pain, right? All it does is cause me suffering, right? How can I get rid of it? How can I kill it? How can I stomp it? How can I leave it behind? How can I get rid of this enemy, as Shantideva would say. And then Shantideva says in the next chapter, mindfulness, awareness. All that is required to become free of ego is to be aware of it, since awareness and ego are incompatible. Awareness is the power that is concealed within the present moment. This is all you need to know. This is how you can observe. So we need to observe. We need to be mindful. We need to be aware of what's arising in our minds. Again, whenever we feel an afflictive emotion, whenever we feel clinging or grasping or attaching or aversion, whenever we feel better than or worse than, self is present. Right? And so the more we are mindful and aware of what is arising in our minds, and when we are aware, you know, of kind of wrong thinking, misidentification, primarily because it's causing us suffering. To be lost in the world of self, you can feel it because it's constricting. There's a constriction in the mind. There's a tightening in the mind. When self is absent, you feel spacious. You feel whole. There's a state of well-being in your mind. But when we're lost in the world of self, in the drama of self, there's drama. How about that one? There's drama. That's our word, right? So if there's drama in your life, self is present. Self's not happy with what's going on. Self wants things to be different, wants you to be different, wants other people to be different. That's all the drama of self. Remember we said it's wanting. And one of the big things that self wants is it wants things to be its way. It wants people to be the way we want them to be. I'll just do one quick thing, then we'll end. Another quote they sent me, it's a little off, but I think it ties in with what I said. He says, in the early stages of so many so-called romantic relationships, people go, I'll play who you want me to be, and you will play who I want you to be. Sound familiar? He says, that's the unspoken unconscious agreement. However, role-playing is hard work. And so these roles cannot be sustained indefinitely, especially once you start living with the person. Just stop a moment. Is there any truth to this? What is commonly called falling in love is in most cases an intensification of egoic wanting and needing. You become addicted to another person, or rather to your image of that person. It has nothing to do with true love, which contains no wanting whatsoever. There is another way. This is our way, right? You know, our way is learning to cultivate true love, which is total acceptance of people and situations. We embrace them with understanding. We embrace them with caring, right? Not with wanting and needing, not with the, you know, role playing, as he says. That's true love. And that's why we want to, you know, get out of the world of self, get out of the world of emotional afflictions. So our natural ability to love and to accept and to be with becomes the way we connect to this world. So good. So that's a little from Chandrakirti, from ancient India, ancient Buddhist tradition of India. And from Eckhart Tolle, a modern, he's still alive, right? Yeah, he's still alive. A modern American who's taking one of these very historical, traditional ways of looking at the world and sort of putting them in kind of modern vernacular. So good. So thank you, everyone. We will stop here. And again, next week, hopefully Gary Hammond will be giving the Mind Seeking the Way talk.